Morning. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia on this exceptionally beautiful fall morning. Now, the United Lodge of Theosophists is within the Theosophical movement, which is a broad-based movement. And we are here to promulgate the original teachings as laid down in the latter part of the 19th century. But the gist of it is that there is a universal brotherhood that connects all of nature. It's that thread that connects all of us, not only as what we see is separate, because we see differences on the surface, but the true spiritual man in all the kingdoms, and it is latent in all the kingdoms. And this study we've been doing on the monad, which we'll conclude next Sunday, addresses that. So there is no distinction or difference between us. We're all the same in potentiality. So we do not discriminate on the basis of race, sex, age, religion, condition. Condition pretty much, that covers everything. It covers all the bases. Now, in order to achieve this, and we do this without bylaws or constitution or officers. So it's really very curious to many newcomers how this works, but it does work. We're an association of students who are dedicated to learning the teachings and then explaining them the best that we can. So we have no dues or fees, but we do have expenses, so Your contributions certainly are welcome and needed, but even the smallest amount goes a long way, given in the right spirit. At the front, in the foyer here, by the fireplace, there is a book table, and contributions can be made there. We sell straight-line theosophical texts and pamphlets for a very reasonable price, only the cost of printing and shipping. And so we have activities during the week. On Wednesday nights, we are studying in the Bhagavad Gita, that great treatise between the higher and the lower. And that will be concluding at the end of the month. We're getting ready to go into our fall, winter, spring, the long semester here. Like a school year, we pretty much follow closely to the typical school year. We will be studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, which is a synthesis of the secret doctrine. And next Sunday, well, this Sunday and next, we are entering the human kingdom. This is where that vivifying principle, the substratum of all life, now is going to manifest itself in the human kingdom. Just caution you that this is preliminary to next week when we say how it actually happens. So questions as to how it actually happens should be asked next week, because that's the conclusion. So the library at the front of the building is open on Wednesday evenings from 5:30 to 7:30. There is a librarian there if you should any questions in finding research material. And so the book table, of course, is open before and after meetings. It's open about 6:30 on Wednesdays until slightly before the meeting begins. That's pretty much it for now, we think. Yes, unless anyone has any other announcements. Okay. So, without any further ado, we will have a student volunteer summarize the part for today, and then afterwards we'll have discussions and comments. Okay, this is our microphone.
So as was said, we're starting a chapter from one of our article books called The Mystery of Individuality, and we're just entering. How does that whole process occur when we're looking at evolution? And the part starts out with a very interesting quote from The Secret Doctrine. It says, it may be a parable and an allegory within an allegory. Now that you can wrap your mind around that one. Its solution is left to the intuition of the student if he only reads with his spiritual eye. So, theosophy then would put forth an evolutionary idea that is quite different than the idea that most of us have grown up with. And we're talking about the lunar petries, also known as the mindless men or lunar monads. And they are looked at as being the builders of the human physical form. So we have to have a form first, and then we're looking at the spiritual essence and how that all happens. And we'll be looking at that next week. They arrive from the moon starting in round one as the early developed human. They continue to arrive on each progressive round until they reach the middle of the fourth round. The most progressed of these lunar petries have the four lower principles as one active unity, but most only had 3.5 principles awakened. Since we're now looking at the process of the lighting up of Manus, we can look at these mindless monads as being of 7 classes, some with 3 principled consciousness up to a full 4 principled being. This occurred some 18 million years ago and several million years before the door to entry into the human kingdom was closed. Since there were 7 classes of mindless men, we can look at it as being 7 methods of exciting the latent mind principle. This is a tentative classification of the incarnating monads. These classes or hierarchies are based upon the respective stages of evolution, consciousness, and merit. Now, since this section that we're looking at today is for those of you that have the sheet, there's a listing of 7 classifications. We're going to be concentrating in this section on number 6. So I'm only going to read number 6, but just so that you all know about the other 6 of them, the remaining 6 are monads of different levels and experience. And you can kind of look at them and see how we can progress. So number 6 reads, those incipient humans who were partially ready and whose latent mind principle was quickened by association with the foregoing classes. This class is said to constitute the majority of mankind today and represents the new crop of men. In prior man Vantaras, they had risen to no higher life than that of represented by the lower kingdoms. In the fifth round, they should reach the status of those in whom lower mind is now fully awake. Included in this class were also monads who, through misuse of their powers, lost their self-consciousness in former Manvantaras and were in the present period obliged again to go through all the elemental kingdoms to gain fresh contact with life and earn a new chance. So no being was ever made self-conscious. It would be impossible to arouse the mind principle unless it had been there all the time. This lighting up process is going on all the time, always is going on and always will be going on. Each kingdom represents an unfoldment of consciousness peculiar to its state and kingdom. The power to become is innate in everything. Human self-consciousness is a stage of that power to become. It is not granted to anyone, but it is considered to be a transitional state leading to that of awareness of the self of all and its accompanying responsibilities. These states are not permanent, but a process of raising ourselves and the lower kingdoms to higher states and eventually to that of direct perception. So we look at this last sentence about it not being permanent as we talk about reincarnation as being the doctrine of hope. So we know that where we are now, if we work and we help others, then we will only progress. So the last two paragraphs on this are mainly some quotes from the Secret Doctrine. And basically what they're saying is that the lords of spiritual life, like the higher beings, in the beginning, they only breathed their essence into men. And this shows that not all men become incarnations, as it is put, the divine rebels, but only a few among them. The remainder had their fifth principle simply quickened by the spark thrown into it, which accounts for the great difference between the intellectual capacities of men and races.
Well, the monad is behind all evolution. It is that impelling force. It is metaphysical. It is really meta-spiritual as well. It's just, it's always there. It's ever present. And it's always able to be availed, in a sense. And it is veiled. It's very much veiled. It is for us to really try with our intuition to read with our spiritual eye this parable, an allegory within an allegory. So it is very mysterious, but it's really something that's very necessary. It's, can one imagine that there not being a basis for all of life? Yes.
Previously, it was mentioned that the monad, being of two very spiritual universal principles, can have no contact with physical life, conditioned life, as we know it. So when it uses the term of monads incarnating, is that part of the allegory of if that spiritual universal monad can't incarnate, what is it we're talking about that does incarnate in different as different classes?
Well, the only connection with the the monad and the and our lives is through our higher mind, that manas, that principle, which is that spark. That it talks about the seven classes, and there needs to be seven classes because we see so many differences, you know, in manifested life, that we realize that it needs to cover all the bases. And within these classes, there are, you know, many, many subdivisions as well, so that everyone can participate, that everything can participate in the evolutionary process. But as far as the monad, it only makes contact with that the higher mind, which is the highest principle. It's the principle that we're working on now in evolution. It doesn't, there's no direct connection and with any other life. Yes.
So what you were saying is that then to all of manifestation, it is through mind or manas or that principle of intelligence that all life comes forward.
That is the impelling principle. That is what we are trying to project onto, ideally, what we are trying to project onto all of the stream of evolution below us. And the various kingdoms below us, in a sense, they're getting indirect contact, and we're trying to impel those lives by our self-sacrificing, our good deeds, our altruism, so that they can be ready in time. But we're not really doing it fully self-consciously, because except for a very few, there at number three it says those that were self-conscious in previous Manvantaras and were helped by the elder brothers to incarnate in the waiting forms because they were not wise enough to do so unaided. So the kingdoms below us are not wise enough to do so unaided, and there are kingdoms above us, but this evolutionary period is for humanity in particular. In the back?
We were just thinking, we all take it for granted that an infant learns to walk, talk, function only because it's imitating what it sees. If you left an infant alone in a room with nothing but food every so often, it would never learn to do those things. It requires someone to spark something.
That's true. And it's isn't it curious that in the other kingdoms, doesn't necessarily hold true, that they could function on their own, they could figure it out, they have it encoded, as it were, in their instinctually. But in the human kingdom, and we see that the phenomenon of failure to thrive, where someone can be fed, perhaps, and fed and watered and diapered, but if there's no real love or caring, that child is going to be retarded. We mean in the sense of, you know, not mental retardation, but just held back. It's holding back. And the center in the bench back there.
But then we're looking at the last sentence. In contact with the four lower principles, the active fifth principle becomes the sparking power. So we wondered if there was an analogy, and we're not sure from the previous comment, we wondered about the analogy that in the cause is the effect, that they're bundled together. If we're in the human stage, then that ability to be, that sparking power, is, as was said, latent in some and active in others, is it a natural, I don't want to say gift, but is it a natural result of the evolutionary process, or is it earned?
Well, everything is earned in evolution, and we are given many chances, because one of the categories are those that, in number 6 at the bottom of the page, it says about there are those who lost their self-consciousness in former manvantaras, and in the present period, they're obliged to go through the whole process from the lowest. They have to pretty much start over again. But it's also a minority. It's a minority of those that have all four principles fully developed and ready to receive that spark, and then they can progress. But for most, they have 3.5 principles. They're just getting their first spark. That's the new crop, as it were. And so we're challenged here to come up with an analogy. I can't think of one right now. Maybe someone else can. Yes.
Well, the Mahatmas say that we, the ones who are actively pursuing these spiritual ideas, are like that crop, and we're waiting for the spark from what they have provided. So it's always a lighting up of manas. We know it ourselves. We wake up and we go, oh, I see, I understand. So it's a progression that goes through all of the kingdoms. But in the human kingdom, we're responsible for that progression.
Okay, so we are responsible through self-induced and self-devised means for our own progression. But we had those instructors who were present. That's another class here. There were sages, and then they were higher than sages. They're planetary guides that incarnated temporarily, and they gave us all of they imprinted all the knowledge that we need to use during evolution. But these great beings later withdrew, leaving the line of succession to lesser sages. So there's always support, there's always help, if we avail ourselves of it. Yes.
I've always heard that once a man, always a man. But in this, it says that you can go back and start all over again at the kingdoms below.
It does, yes.
Man. Now, is that just a manvantaric law? In other words, always a man?
Well, that's... once a man, always a man, in that we are really descended from the solar petries. Okay, the lunar petries provide the body. They provide the material. So yes, once a man, always a man. Maybe it's more or less like a refresher course because of misuse of powers, the self-consciousness was lost, but there's still a man as far as we can tell.
Well, just as was pointed out, once a man means once a self-conscious thinker, always a self-conscious thinker, and that self-conscious thinker cannot incarnate into lower kingdoms. But in this case, as was pointed out, that principle of self-consciousness is lost, so it has to be regained, and it can only be regained by contact with earlier experiences. It's very much the same if we have had a traumatic injury or even a stroke, that we have to go back, and we've lost certain skills that we had, but we have to go back and relearn how to tie our shoes, how to feed ourselves, how to do many of the things we learned.
learned years ago in order to progress to where we were before we lost those skills.
In the back.
Well, we're thinking there's your analogy. It is always a teacher offering to someone who is ready something that will bring them up to that level. Or you could say it's always a family with the elders in the family encouraging the younger. It's always just the same.
Yes.
And yet if we step back to the animal kingdom, we can see in many different animals that same system going on, that mother training a child up to a certain point, the elders that also have a hand in it, that type of instinctual intelligence to give to those the younger babies, younger animals.
Right, and there's often, there's in this room, there's, it's difficult, like animals, there are many, many very intelligent animals, and it's amazing how adaptive they are. And I mean, even to give an example, in the past 10 years, we don't really remember there being that many hawks in the city. But in the last 10 years, they're now all over the place. Less pigeons, more hawks. But they're now becoming a common sight if you look up in the sky. So there is definitely adaptability, there's intelligence, but there's not the self-reflective, self-conscious intelligence. They see, they act, they have a body of knowledge, as it were, in that kingdom, but they're acting instinctually. Leibniz uses the term, he invented the term apperception, and that is like consciousness that's aware of itself, or self-reflective consciousness. And that's in the human kingdom, and that's actually, there's a spark of that in most of humanity, but much of humanity is not really all that self-reflective or self-conscious. There's degrees of it. So we're just, for the bulk of humanity, we're working on that. There are some that are fully awake and aware, and their mind principle is developed, but they're the minority.
This phenomenon of the mind principle opening up, it's oftentimes associated with the heart. And the fact that you bring up a very interesting point about hawks and so forth, well, the reason that we see more is because we no longer destroy them in great numbers. We no longer make it a sport, and we no longer wear it in our hats, and our, you know, and things have changed because the mind has become more compassionate to the rest of life. And I think this is what this whole part is about in that last, very last paragraph, is that we would not be here if it was not for the sacrifice of other beings, and the being of light, or these divine rebels, you know, but that is our purpose, is us to sacrifice life for life. And that's what the other kingdoms do for us as well. They all sacrifice unto this higher kingdom. And we have this choice, and what do we do with it?
Yes, we think about rebels, we think about a divine rebel. It comes to mind Martin Luther King Jr. He was definitely a divine rebel. He saw his duty, and he was unstoppable until he was assassinated, unfortunately. But he just was, that's a minority, someone who's that tenacious and that dedicated, and he was working for the good of all. He had gone beyond strictly working for one, trying to elevate one race, to try to elevate all the races and all of the oppressed classes, because he saw he had a universal mindset. And Mahatma Gandhi too, who was very much influenced, who very much influenced Martin Luther King. They see universally. They see the need, and they're unstoppable. That, of course, he was assassinated too. So that stops a lot of people from even thinking about it, because, but yet there is no, really though, what we're told is that there is no life, there is no secession, there is no stoppage. You can't stop this. It's just goes on. Yes.
So those being great examples of the better use or the best use of these principles we're discussing, then it makes sense that those who sort of drift through life or purposely misuse these powers should be held back, should go to the back of the class or repeat the class. It makes perfect sense.
Oh yeah, it's exactly, it's only fair. If you're, we can take a physical example of an alcoholic who keeps drinking, and they know that they're abusing their liver, and then they may even get a liver transplant. There was a, we won't mention the name, but there was a famous person who got a liver transplant, and then he blew through that too. I mean, it's but we are given other chances. We again and again, but we will have to, in a sense, go to the back of the room, or go to another school, or if we flunk out of one, we'll be sent to another one. If we flunk out of Harvard, then we might end up in community college, and we're not saying that's a bad thing, because that might be what that soul needs to do, is to go to community college and take their studies seriously, or just completely drop out. Yes.
But even that individual who can't get over an addiction in that sense,
right,
is a rebel, because they're rebelling against what they have the power to choose,
yes,
and they're rebelling against what their reason, maybe even common sense, tells them. And that capacity to choose, to go against law, which is not present in any other kingdom, is because we are all, in essence, those incarnated divine rebels, to one degree, who chose to go against the spiritual state so they could incarnate and light up and help the further progress. So we have that. That's part of our spiritual inheritance, in that sense.
Yes. And there are allegories in the Bible, and you know, the story of Lucifer, who's really the divine rebel, Prometheus, the divine rebel, and the true story of Lucifer is, you know, not what it's come down to us at, that it's an evil thing, but Lucifer, the angel of light, the morning star, the one who, if we just, the other side is, if we just do what we're told without thinking, we end up in, like Germany in World War II. I mean, we're just blindly following along, and that's a much greater horror, much, much greater horror. This gentleman in the denim there?
In two, it's there's a reference to planetary guides. Does that translate into archangels? Is that the same as the archangels?
Well, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. Is there a difference between a planetary guide and an archangel? Or are guides one level of progression and an archangel something? The Dion Chohans, yes.
Well, we always thought very interesting the Jewish tradition, you know, Jehovah and then Sigurdaka says Jupiter, and we always thought we couldn't quite comprehend all that, but there, perhaps this is the association of a planetary guide that, you know, came and brought, you know, told the truth to a group of people.
Well, and there are seven planetary spirits that are connected with, they're not the same as, they're associated with the seven sacred planets, but there are four archangels, aren't there? So then we have to wonder, is it, are they one and the same? Are they different? Yes?
Well, we think in some of the symbolism of the archangels described, that they are associated by symbol and myth to various planets. And so there seems to be some connection there that they represent the guiding intelligence or informing intelligence of evolution. Because we have to understand that these, when we progress in our intelligence to a certain state, we are not just involved with the evolution of those humans less involved in our, than our, less evolved than ourselves, but we're looking out for and guiding all of life. It's the analogy, a teacher just doesn't instruct her students, but tries to work with the system and the classroom and the technology and all the things that will help those students evolve better. So there, these intelligences are, you might say, informing and guiding all of life.
So these intelligences are all pervasive. There's no stoppage. There's no compartmentalization. They are diffuse. Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I asked that question because there is, and I'm not a Bible scholar, so I don't expect an exact quote, but I asked that question because often in the Bible and in the Quran, it's a we. And it, I've heard that that means a certain divine counsel. Even in the beginning of the Bible, it says, if we continue, we'll make men will be as we are. In other words, we'll raise them in their intelligence. And this seems to have such a reference on what we're speaking of today that I thought it was important.
Well, the divine rebels have the power of choice, whereas they don't. So we're really greater than them. They're jealous because we are greater than them. We get to make our own choices. We get to suffer for them and make when we make mistakes, but still we have that ability.
Yeah. If one is really interested in this, they can study in the secret doctrine, you know, planetary spirits and the hierarchies, but it's really all given to us as myth and allegory to provoke us to think about ourselves. We were thinking of an analogy with the alcoholism that you mentioned earlier and the responsibility. It's like if I am the driver of a car and I wreck that car, I'm still a driver. I can get a different car. Now, maybe because of what it cost me, I can only get a junker, but it's a car. And I will learn new things and gather new responsibilities. So the thinker never loses the opportunity to choose, but it may lose the opportunity to participate in evolution and have to sleep and wake up in the next one.
Right. There, and it says in number 6 about those, again, they lost their self-consciousness. Well, it was due to abuse. It was... They were rebels. They rebelled again and again, and to the point where it was self-defeating. But yet they weren't. That choice is never taken away. And how many of those will come back, get another chance, but still have those same tendencies because they reinforce them again and again? I mean, is it a completely clean slate, or do tendencies from former periods of evolution come back? What do you think? What do you think? Yes.
Well, tendencies from former periods of evolution may come back, but in that period of evolution, that new period, they are in association with those who have made progress mm-hmm. and who are even wiser to help them in conditions that are even better than the ones they had before. So nature or law not only gives them the opportunity, another chance, but but gives them the opportunity to succeed in even better conditions than they had before.
Okay, so could we use the analogy of a bad boy, we'll just put it that way, who goes to reform school, he gets in some trouble, he has adverse circumstances, but in there, he's forced to settle down because of all the external controls, but then makes the choice that he's going to make something better of his life. And it's also discovered that he really has intelligence. He has an innate intelligence that was not recognized because he was acting out. So then he's put into a better school and he has a choice. I can start a clean slate, or I can try to seek those elements that I was associated with before. Yes.
You're describing a condition that surrounded the life of Louis Armstrong, who was born into very poor circumstances, but at a young age, and very adverse circumstances, but at a young age was adopted by a family who recognized his abilities and gave him the opportunities, so by through his own efforts he could fully become the human being he was capable of, that he couldn't do in those initial conditions.
So that's, apparently these are analogies and correspondences for that that fresh start that we can get, and that we all are given eventually, even if we lose everything, and even from life to life, someone can die destitute, in poverty. We can use the example of Thomas Paine, all of his suffering that he did. He was a divine rebel, and he sparked the revolution. He definitely sparked the revolution, and he was vilified because he also said some unflattering things about George Washington and the church. So he was vilified and he died pretty much destitute. And today his memory is still vilified, but he's an example of that tenaciousness. Yes.
And his body is still missing.
Right.
A British citizen came and took it from the New Rochelle farmstead that New York had given him,
right.
And he said we weren't treating it respectfully, and no one knows where it is.
Yeah, well, did the same to Lincoln too, but they found it eventually. Yes?
I was wondering, it seems that when one is born, you're born with a certain set of characteristics, intelligence, emotional IQ, etc., and that it is, and then you're born into certain circumstances, and that it's very hard to evolve, even if we study these spiritual principles, beyond that level. It's very hard to, you know, typical thinking, traditional thinking, it's very hard to evolve from an IQ standpoint. It's very difficult to evolve, even if you have certain personality traits, to change those traits because maybe your brain functions in a different way. How do these principles explain that?
How do these principles explain?
Or how, you know, if I would think it would be very difficult to then evolve beyond, you know, a certain level when you are incarnated into the world under certain conditions.
Well, yes, that's the challenge for each and every one of us, and especially those that are really seeking to better themselves, because there's many that aren't. They're comfortable, they're complacent, they think they've been handed all the right cards, that they're playing their hand out perfectly, and yet they can be doing untold damage to themselves and their environment just because of that attitude, that sin of separateness, where they feel that They are separate, they are better, and it exists in the East and the West. It exists very much in lands that believe in karma. They feel that those poor people are getting what they deserve. But that is the challenge for each and every one of us. If you are a seeker, then you're seeking to transcend the limitations, because there's so much more beyond. There's so much that we can see and imagine such a better world than the one we have today. I mean, it's like there are still so many obvious glaring faults. I mean, just look at the wars. We're constantly at war. The whole world is somewhere. It seems like one quarter of the world is always at war. It seems like, and so how do we know there's a better way? We know that there's conciliation and peace. But yes, go ahead.
One of the things about the idea of evolving, we're looking at the personality in any particular life, which is temporary. In order to really understand or to get an idea of picture, we have to imagine, since we can't actually see, the longer span and breadth of our existence, not only in that one life, but in lives that have preceded it and lives that will follow it. We learn in this life what we need, and hopefully to make changes in the upcoming lives. So just trying to see it through one life, and that's not to say give up, because we do make changes. Even against all these adverse conditions, we do make changes. The things we see, the things we feel, the things we learn help us to make changes, or else we wouldn't sit in this room week after week looking for these things.
And we can have...
Overall, it's longer than just one life.
Well, yes, that's the view, that if it's many people believe that this is the one life and that's it, and if you don't make it, oh well, too bad. But the long view is that we work, we make a beginning, we have hopes and aspirations, and we work toward them. And if they're not realized, it's frustrating. It is definitely frustrating. But we can never stop, because if we believe that there are those great beings who have done this, they've been through that, and they've done it, and they've achieved it, and they've achieved the highest perfection that is available, then we can too. They were just like us.
The reality is, we're told again and again that the universe evolves from within without. So we are the same way. We are the universe. So if we want to change, or we want to become more than what we are, we have to make a filter, or we have to make a pathway for this divine rebel to incarnate. And it's through ideas. It's basic ideas. This philosophy gives us fundamental ideas which we need to saturate our thoughts and our ideas and our life with. And the world will change before us from within outward. We will change by living the life.
Right. And those who are self-conscious need to help the new crop of men. Those who are, the lower mind is not fully awake. So that is our duty.
Back to the question, we may have personality traits that interfere with our ability to do what was just said. Maybe we can't concentrate, or maybe however hard we try to be altruistic, there's a counter feeling within us that won't let us do it. But that's all right, because karma is not linear. It's not straight line from one life to another. In our next life, we may have opportunities that will allow us to build the strength. When we face those traits in another life, we'll be able to handle them. So we cannot give up hope.
No, we should.
We are the power of thought and will and choice. We've made this mess. We can clean this mess.
we should never give up hope. And the analogy is used about being a hothouse, being in a hothouse. Well, that's when flowers, they bloom. They that's how you can get orchids in the middle of, you know, you can get orchids off season all year round because there are hothouses where the conditions are such that they force it to bloom. And that's what we are forced into. Adverse conditions, we can run and we can retreat, or we can bloom. Yes.
So maybe one of the ways of looking with the spiritual eye, as is said in there, is to look at each of those difficult hothouse conditions we encounter as opportunities for growth, because that may be the only way that that lesson can be learned for us. And if we open the door and let the air in so that it doesn't happen, we will have a harder time perhaps the next time it comes around, because the law will bring it around again. We have earned it. We have created it, as was said, so we're the only ones who can fix it and make it better.
But sometimes the hardest times are actually the best times. They're the most productive when we can't retreat, when we really have to act. And you know, we see people acting like, I mean, those, just last week, there was a man, he saw the car coming and he figures, I'm going to ditch this bike. Basically, he's got to jump off the bike before the bike hits, which is actually a good evasive maneuver. But he ended up under a car and his bike hit the car, and the car was in flames. And so it took 17 people to lift that car up, and then somebody dragged him out, and he couldn't get over the selflessness of all those people and how they saved him. And he's young, he's going to be recovered in 6 to 8 weeks, full recovery within 6 to 8 weeks. So somebody my age that wouldn't happen to, but you know, but he's got that good karma going for him. He's young. Yes.
And those last two lines of the reading, it said, in contact with the four lower principles, the active fifth principle becomes the spark and power. So the personality that was previously described, with all its difficulties and obstacles, primarily there because of the misuse of the desire principle, the fourth principle. It's because of the presence of that principle, even if it causes us problems, that sparks us to make changes. If we look at ourselves honestly, we see very often it is extreme discontent with our lower nature rather than inspiration from the higher that gets us moving, that
right.
gets us changing.
Yeah, there's an expression. There's an expression that some recovery groups use, and that's, "I didn't see the light; I felt the heat." So this whole process of these seven classes is it's there. It's there for all kingdoms. It's there for those beings that are above us, that give us a hand. And then at the midpoint of evolution, which Theosophy says is 18 million years ago, when we split into male and female forms, that we know that the forms were being working on, but it needed that mind principle, that animating principle. And then the thinker comes upon the scene, and many of the great tales and legends have been passed down about these gods that did walk the earth. They were gods. They were just as we are gods unto the kingdoms below us. They, yes.
Well, what makes us what we are, if we're gods of potential, is, and we find that, you know, where we've come from, we didn't feel responsible for life. We can blame someone else or some other thing. But now we come to this, these ideas, and we find that when we become responsible for all our acts and deeds and thoughts, is when we become more like gods, or more like human beings, or, you know, or greater than the animal being that we see around us. So it's the responsibility that one must feel for all of life that makes us divine. Apparently, from what we read today, and even our own nature, you know, if we feel, you know, responsible, we feel, you know, that we need to do more than what we're doing.
So are you saying that the feeling of responsibility for all of life makes us as gods?
Well, makes, yes, in the sense that we have a compassion or a caring for life, that we feel responsible in some way, shape, or form. Whether we can do anything about it is another question, but that feeling of responsibility, so therefore the little world in which we live, we try to put it in order.
But we do live in a microcosm, that every element that is in the world is also, and in the cosmos, is also within our body. We're a small cosmos, and the heart is really the center. The heart is like the sun, and we say that somebody has a good heart, or that they're kind-hearted, and we see them doing great acts of charity, great acts that are selfless, and everyone admires that. Yes?
Just an overall comment. You think that many of us will observe that this particular summer study has been challenging because of the language of the secret doctrine. And a wonderful job was done this morning by many to take these ideas and express them in everyday language that we can understand and apply. But why wasn't that done from the beginning? Why did the masters, understanding us as we are, why did they use such complicated metaphysical language when it was much easier just said it like we're saying?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if we can speak for the masters, but we can only try to see with our spiritual eye that if we don't learn the lessons ourselves, they're not done. If we're given the answers, if somebody, you know, today we wouldn't use this term when we were going to school, but if somebody hacked into the system and got all the answers to the exam, then what do we learn? We forget about it. But if we really have to go through the lessons and struggle, and we have to understand too that the English language is one that's evolved over time, but the original works were written in languages from periods past which were much more precise, and but still, even then, we have to learn for ourselves. It is a loving act that we have to struggle and learn, because if we're given everything, we'll never learn. Yes.
I would definitely agree with that statement. It's almost, I come from kind of like a martial arts background, and it's a difference between giving someone a fish and teaching them how to fish. It's when I teach people something, I try and teach from a principle perspective as opposed to teaching from a, shall we say, a technique perspective. I can teach you a technique, but then you're just stuck with that technique. If I teach you a principle, then you have infinite applications of that principle as opposed to just being stuck with that technique. So you come to it at a level of understanding that is appropriate for you as an individual, but as your understanding grows, you get more out of it. So maybe that was the necessity of writing it in the manner that they did, because as time goes by, every time you read it, you get a different understanding of it. So when you first read it, you might get one understanding of it, and then time goes by, you get more experience, and you read it again, you get something totally different out of reading that same thing, because you've grown in your level of experience and your level of understanding.
Thank you. One quick final one.
Yes, this is a perfect quote, and we've forgotten who wrote it. A man's reach should exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for?
Yeah. Excellent. And we will be reaching and grasping for the final for a long time. So please come next week for the final installment of this most challenging of studies. Meeting is adjourned. Hi, good to see you again.
But you have to turn it off because if you
I turned it off, didn't I? I pressed
no,
it.
This.
And then I was going to do that.
Oh, okay.
Preempted
this
me.
Right there. Just because.